"Death is a chore which needed attending to," Carmen said. "The nine nights are a celebration of a life well lived. Our loved one no longer suffers with this life." "But one so young," Holly said. "You're never too young to know the sting of life. Friends soon come, not with their condolences and sad faces, but with food and drink and music. Life." "It goes on all week?" I asked. "On the ninth night, the family prepares the food for all who come. Some say that the night the spirit of our loved one passes through to say goodbye."
"Spirits?" Owen perked up.
"Look how the Dappy kissed me last night." Carmen turned her arm over to reveal a bruise.
Then she grinned as if letting us in on some joke.
"Did you have any problems with your arrival?"
"There was a police roadblock, like they were searching for something," Owen said.
"Police? Big talk buffoons, the lot of them. If one stop you, he's just trying to get a let off. All them wanting money in return for doing their job. No, sir."
"I thought they might be looking for our guns," Holly said.
"American guns drop into Kingston like mangoes from a tree," Carmen said.
"Then what about the deaths?" I asked.
"The police just collect the bodies and file a report. Natural causes." Carmen sucked her teeth.
"But our report said the bodies had been drained?"
"No one cares about a poor dead child."
Carmen took a glass of sorrow when her maid passed her the tray. I took a glass of sorrow.
"Do you have any idea what's behind the killings? My mother used to tell stories that her mother told her.
I only vaguely remember Duppies and the spinning cow."
"Oh, that takes me back. I haven't heard or told a Brer Nancy story in forever. Nor a
spinning cow." Carmen rocked back with laughter. She repeated the spinning cow reference to her maid so quickly in thick patois that I barely recognized the words as English.
"I think you meant rolling calf."
Hoping Holly and Owen didn't notice, I flushed with mild embarrassment. I took a deep sip of sorrel. It tasted like bitter fruit with a dash of ginger. Not used to it, I wanted to spit it right back into my glass. What Holly said was true. I was a little more than a tourist here now.
"Did your mother ever tell you about old Hike?"
I shook my head.
"All these gals keep going on and on about it round here when they should be working. I normally don't have time for such foo-foo nonsense."
"But you suspect something," I said.
"I've seen a lot of things. I was the first call my people made. Not the police, not the hospital, not the family. Me. Because my people, them know I will do whatever it takes to look out for them. I saw the body myself. Poor little child. Little more than a week old. The life drained from it. Sometimes even the best people turn wrong."
Her voice took on a mournful quality.
"If people swear that an old hag stalks these parts, I'm not quick to dismiss it. Whatever it takes, missy. Whatever, whatever, whatever. But sometimes it's best to keep things in the family, so to speak."
Owen leaned forward.
"I just need to know one thing. Bullets, fire, or axe? If we're gonna go hunting, I need to know what to pack with me."
"Jesus,"
Carmen said with such emphasis the word almost had an extra syllable.
"Do you know I came home one day to find rice scattered all over the house? Them gals," she cocked her head toward her maids, "said the community set a trap for the old hag. She flew about in the night looking for her next victim, drawn by the smell of asafoetida. So them pile up rice now. Say that the old hag has to count the grains, and if she loses track, she has to start over."
"Did it work?" I asked.
"You know a monster who stops its rampage to count rice grains. I told them to sweep it up and quit wasting my rice. We have a whole community to feed. Go talk to Lord Evader. He loves to chat.
The taxi driver?
Driver, handyman, gravedigger. Used to be a reggae singer a lifetime or two ago.
Like Bob Marley? Owen asked.
That's reggae for people who don't know reggae. Overproduced for easy consumption,
Carmen said.
I like Bob Marley,
Owen whispered.
You might as well order Rasta pasta back at that hotel resort.
With a self-satisfied grin, Carmen waved us on our way.
It's the last night of the 9 nights, and we begin about 7. See you in the morning, if life spare.
The sky threatened to rain. The heavy air smelled of salt and damp sand. The trees crowded in, assuming thick huddles, but soon opened up. 2 guard dogs barked in the distance. At the center of the clearing, a man dug a small hole. A machete poked from the earth like a marker. A tiny cardboard box filled with 4 bottles of Jamaican rum sat next to it. Lord Evader had changed into a denim shirt and threadbare dungarees. Hopping out of the small grave, he straightened his bowler hat, then swiped up his machete, carrying it on his shoulder like it was a backpack, and he was on his way to school.
Catch you at a bad time?
Owen crept his hand to his Jericho. Lord Evader swaggered past the box of rum and stabbed the dirt with his machete before plopping down. He laid out an array of marijuana and papers with the sacrosanct air of preparing for communion. After rolling his spliff, he offered it up.
Do you like to blow bush tea?
I'm good. I held my hands up. Lord Evader leaned his head back and let a thick plume of smoke issue from his mouth.
Me too. Full of vibes. I bet you are.
Owen moved his hand away from his Jericho. I elbowed him gently. We hear you're the go-to guy for ghost stories. Sorry, duppy stories.
Puppy?
Holly whispered to Owen.
Shh,
Owen said.
Dem say dat duppy dead out, Lord Evader said. The Maroons consider the cotton tree sacred. They believe duppies often danced among the branches of those rooted in graveyards.
Carmen said you could tell us more about the old hag?
Holly raised her voice with uncertainty.
Old hag. Yes, man. That what we call any old witch. I grew up around here, not 2 miles from this very spot. I remember when I was a boy, having to walk past the house of an old hag. The chill that crawled up and down my back like stepping in front of death. This haggish-looking woman, ageless, years upon years upon years. My grandmother told me she used to provide the witch with food. Since we barely had food for our part, it wasn't fair, I said. But my grandmother warned me that taking care of her was for our own protection. But then, children started to die mysteriously. That was when we all knew what we was dealing with was a true old hag. But we were too scared to confront her. We just made cross marks by the house and hung a blue cross over the cradle of any new baby. But soon she disappeared. One night, a fireball left her house, and she was never seen again.
A fireball?
Yes, man. The old hag waits until early morning, when everyone is asleep. She sheds her skin like a snake, and then transforms into a ball of fire. Flies from her house and lands on the roof of another. If there is a baby in a cradle, she will suck it dry, dry, dry. Only then does she go home.
So, vampire,
Owen turned to me.
Why didn't your aunt just say skin-shedding vampire?
This just gets better and better, Holly said.
Old hag would hang her skin on branches as a warning. If her skin is found before it is put back on, salt and pepper or vinegar thrown on it, that ends her.
rice, salt and pepper, vinegar. At this rate, I don't know whether to cut its head off or toss a salad, Owen said.
Lord Vader continued, his yellow eyes focused on me.
She may have a raw body, skinny fingers, and red eyes, but in the end, she just an old witch. Miss Carmen knows. She thinks she hide it, but I know her mother was a powerful Obima. She worked the old ways, set dopies on people. People they come trouble her or vex up about them neighbor or something. She'd work Obi on them and seldom ask for anything.
Her mother? I feared where this might be heading.
Her mother lives here too?
When life hard, you try anything.
Lord Vader stared long and hard at me. He held the burning spliff between his fingers and gestured at me.
You and Obi-Wan do.
I don't think so.
You have faith. So if an Obi-Wan or an Obi-Ma tried to work Obi on you, it wouldn't work. Your faith, it has been bruised. You've seen things and have your doubts. Like passing clouds over the sun, but the light is still there waiting to burst through.
I stood there, suddenly self-conscious of all eyes trained on me.
Where's the guest house?
Owen chimed in, sparing me any more discomfort.
You're there.
Lord Vader cast his arms about, waving him toward the small shed.
We are back where Miss Carmen buries the things she doesn't like to think about.
You gotta be freaking kidding me. I might as well sleep in a tree. Look, I'm securing the perimeter. You two get yourselves pretty. If this thing likes to come out before daybreak, we'll just have to hunt it down tonight before it can hit its snooze button.
I prepared to leave, but Lord Vader took me by the arm.
No one appreciates the stories like they used to. The old hag may be the last of her kind. After this, she may only live on in stories, but there are fewer and fewer storytellers. Like I told you, you hunting your heritage.
Aunt Carmen had small bottles of Jamaican rum cream set out on the dresser, which tasted like a vanilla milkshake spiked with rum. A mosquito net over the bed fluttered in the breeze. A lizard skidded across the wall, stopped, and stared at me as if I were the one intruding. Staring through the curtainless window, I rested on top of the made bed in my full body armor. Body armor was not designed for tropical climes. My fellow monster hunters always liked to say that I'd get used to the heat. They lied, but I did get used to the protection it offered. Despite being suited up, I felt the pressure of an incoming storm closing in. Wind swept through the leaves of the breadfruit trees, which sounded like rainfall. A chirping chorus of cicadas filled the night.
You all right?
Holly fastened the last part of her body armor as she came out of the bathroom. I don't know how to explain it. For a long time, I've just felt so disconnected from everything, like I have no roots to ground me. I don't know. Maybe it's just the idea of being able to help out family.
Even family so distant you couldn't pick them out of a lineup? Holly asked.
Like I said, I don't know how to explain it. I just have a hole gnawing at me. Something missing. I just need to see this through. I close my eyes. Still have the nightmares, you know.
About the zombies?
Holly stared at me with those blue eyes of hers that never missed anything. It seemed like my life kept coming back to voodoo of some sort. It was a voodoo priestess who terrorized my home in Florida, stirring up zombies, which I had to put down with a pickaxe. All the talk about Obi and the undead left me more on edge than I was ready to admit.
Yeah, this mission, it's just got me all turned around. Like, there's a debt that I owe.
You don't owe anyone anything, Trip. Holly sat on the edge of the bed. She put her hand on my arm. I'm only going to say this once,
and if you ask me about it later, I'll deny it. But you're a good man, John Jermaine Jones.
Thank you. Mrs. John Jermaine Jones. Holly punched me in the leg. We slipped out the back entrance of Carmen's house. A DJ had begun to spin a few dance hall tracks while people milled about in line for food. We couldn't escape all the curious stares. Two Americans in paramilitary gear would certainly stir the rumor mill. Carmen nodded her approval. When we turned the corner, Owen was slipping a tank onto his back.
"What is that?" I asked.
"The XM-42 flamethrower. These are perfectly legal to use to clear weeds. Or snow."
"Though clearing the undead is probably an off-brand use."
"Never fight high-level undead without one," Owen said.
A few scattered houses hid behind Carmen's property. Dilapidated shacks, I thought abandoned, save for the furtive movement of extinguishing a gas lamp at our approach. The sounds of the nine knights retreated to the main house. The hillside took on a foreboding aspect at night, its crests and tree line a series of shadows against an indigo sky full of more stars than I could ever remember seeing. We formed a skirmish line with Holly on point. She hefted the Negev machine gun like it was an extension of her arm.
"Did you hear that?" I asked.
"Hear what?" Owen said.
"Exactly. It all stopped. No birds, no cicadas. Everything's quiet."
A small path cut through the overgrown trees. Owen tromped through the woods. "I used to play football in college, and it would be easy to confuse Owen with a simple bruiser, but he knew how to use his bulk when he moved. His bulky frame pushed through like he dared nature to get in his way."
"Anything?" I asked into the comlink.
"Nothing yet." Holly moved further ahead of us.
"Wait, I may have a trail. Leads back past the property line. Got some houses back there."
I had the undefinable feeling that we were being watched. Something stalked the woods alongside us, waiting for its time to strike. Tree branches crunched loudly underfoot, each twig snapping and echoing across the hills. I'd grabbed the Beretta 1301 tactical shotgun and carried it at the low ready. I switched to my helmet-mounted night vision monocular. Though I had a 1,000-lumen Nightcore MH-12 LED flashlight affixed to my shotgun, a second light casting the world in green was picked up by the monocular. The trees loomed tall overhead, now so thick they blocked the night sky. Anything could hide among their high limbs. Owen had the same idea, spending as much time scanning the branches above as the path in front of us. Holly pointed to the nearest house and signaled that she was going around back. I stepped to the front door. It didn't quite fit in the frame, as if the house had been assembled from spare materials.
"Let's see if anyone's home," Owen said.
The house was a small, open room with two tiny windows. Broken bottles lined the shelves. In the center of the floor was a brass bowl with dried blood on it. All manner of teeth lay scattered around it. Other bowls sat on a makeshift bench, half filled with grave dirt.
"What do you think?"
Owen sifted through a pile of dirt.
"Witch?" Holly stood by the rear door.
"Definitely a witch," I said. I paused at a framed photo on a shelf, a picture of an older woman next to a young Carmen, who could be her twin in another 10 years. The air temperature dropped several degrees. I set the photograph back on the shelf with calculated care, not wanting to make any sudden movements.
"We've got company," I whispered.
A woman stood in the corner, hunched over, like a grandmother, whose arthritic bones barely allowed her to stand.
"Trip, go to white light."
Holly yelled in my ear. I flipped my monocular back and activated the night core on the forearm of my shotgun. The light filled the small room with such intensity it seared our eyes for a moment. That moment froze in time. The old woman reared, her skinless body a mass of pulsing, moist muscle and tendons. A mane of gray hair stuck to the undulating flesh of her face. Her brown eyes stared at me as if from behind a pink mask of freshly butchered meat. The old hag tensed, her movements slow and deliberate, her bones aged and full of ache. Her slow grind of teeth approximated a smile. With only a hiss as a warning, she sprang at me. Her bare fist struck me in the gut with the weight of having slipped on a set of brass knuckles. The blow landed deep, and with such force I nearly vomited. I doubled over and left my feet, flying into the shack wall. Plates toppled from the shelves, crashing all around me. I struggled to my feet and assumed a fighting stance, my legs unsteady beneath me. I feared I might appear drunk. Without skin to interpret the movements of her facial muscles, her face was an emotionless, blank canvas. Her eyes refused to blink. Weaponless, I threw a series of quick jabs. She let the blows land. She kicked me in the chest. All air left my lungs. I had the sensation of plunging into deep, cold waters. Holly opened fire. The old hag howled as the shells ripped into her. She threw her head back, and time seemed to slow. Debris wafting in the air got caught up in an invisible stream and ignited. Her body erupted into flames before collapsing in on itself, forming a ball of flame. The incandescent ball shot upward through the roof and back the direction we came. "Come on!" I yelled. We ran through the woods at full speed. The old hag landed squarely atop Lord Evader's house. It screeched. With a bottle of rum in one hand, Lord Evader stumbled out of his room, took one look at the old hag, and held his arms up to shield himself. I ran and tackled him, barely avoiding the swipe of one of her wizened claws. She shredded the back of my armor. Holly provided cover fire. The creature slowed, wanting to chase after me, but needing to deal with the more immediate threat first.
"Come and get some!"
Holly yelled. She swung the Negev back in its direction. I pointed Lord Evader back to Carmen's house before heading back to flank the creature. On my way, I grabbed Lord Evader's machete. I turned it over in my hands. Just like old times. Holly had the beams of her night core trained on the old hag, but I noticed something fluttering in the trees behind it.
"Owen, behind you! In the trees!"
A low-hanging branch of a cotton tree, stark and loathsome in the dim light, had something quavered along it, like thick, ropey spider webs tangled among its limbs. The old hag's skin.
"I'm all out of salt," Owen yelled. "This will have to do."
Owen let loose with the flamethrower. Streams of fire lit up the countryside. The old hag turned toward Owen and wailed like a mother grieving the loss of its child. Holly ceased fire as I neared the creature.
"Over here," I said.
The old hag turned in time to see the swing of my blade as it sliced through its throat. The blade lodged in the beast's neck. Rather than pull it free to chance another swing, I fell on top of her and drove the blade the rest of the way through. I laid on top of her, face to face, the last fetid puff of breath escaping her mouth before her head tumbled from her body. Holly and Owen carted up the remains of the old hag and gave Carmen and me some space for privacy.
Thank you.
Carmen watched them load the body. That's what family's for, to take care of one another and deal with the problems outsiders wouldn't understand. There was another Hebrew word that always stuck with me, mishpacha, which means family. I glanced at Holly and Owen, who waved me to hurry along before the police arrived with questions I didn't feel like answering. In the end, it was the people to whom you belonged, who always had your back, who were family. And family took care of family.
It is difficult to verify if this historical account is authentic or an elaborate forgery. I include it here because, if true, the ramifications are very troubling. A.L.
The Bride, Brad R. Torgerson.
Grandfather, the young man said, standing deferentially in the doorway to Benjamin Franklin's study.
William, the older man said over his shoulder, his bespectacled face illuminated by the oil lamp perched on his writing desk. The quill in his hand was still poised over the parchment, upon which he'd been quickly scribbling. Now, more than ever, Benjamin Franklin's world was a whirlwind of correspondence.
There are two gentlemen at the door, the young man said.
Frenchmen? The old man asked.
No, grandfather. Or at least only one of them is French. They say they're from... It's regarding General Washington, sir. About the army. They say they can help.
Benjamin Franklin's spine straightened, and he slowly turned to the side to stare at his grandson and secretary and personal aide over the rims of his round glasses. It was late in the evening for such unannounced and uninvited visitors. Very odd indeed.
Who?
The old man asked, his left eyebrow arched slightly.
The first is Hessian. Someone calling himself Van Steuben?
It's Von Steuben,
a French-accented voice corrected loudly from behind William's position.
And the Baron is Prussian.
Two men appeared behind William, and the young man nervously clasped his hands together, looking from his grandfather's face to the faces of the visitors and back again. A commoner would have been promptly remonstrated for interrupting Franklin's peace and quiet. But the Baron was someone already acquainted with Franklin, so the American diplomat sighed a long, tired exhale and beckoned the two men forward.
"It's all right, William," the old man said. "Please make sure the front door is closed. I am sure whatever business the Baron has brought to me tonight can be handled expeditiously."
William dipped his chin in acknowledgment and shuffled quickly from the doorway. The Baron strode in, followed by his ever-present attaché, Louis de Pontierre, who closed the study door behind them.
"The answer is still no," Franklin said, standing up from his small bench at the desk and placing the tips of his fingers into a pocket on his vest over his ever-growing belly.
The American diplomat wasn't a spring chicken any longer, and the various parlors and courts of Paris kept him well supplied with a variety of culinary delicacies. Perhaps too well supplied? Not that it mattered much. Franklin wasn't marching with Washington. He was a persuader, not a fighter. And thus far, his mission, as envoy to France, had been going extremely well. The French liked him. They liked his ideas. They liked his sense of humor. He was winning them over. But not everyone was pleased with what Franklin had been able to tell them. Von Steuben turned to his young aide and barked out something in guttural Deutsch.
"The Baron says he understands you won't make any promises which your Continental Congress cannot keep,"
Louis said, his English proficient and refined.
"But the Baron also wishes to inform you that the situation has changed."
"Oh?"
Ben Franklin said, taking a couple of steps forward.
"In what way?" Louis briefly translated the question for the Baron, who again replied in Deutsch.
The Baron says he has been made aware of a terrible new weapon, being prepared by Landgrave Frederick at the direct request of King George, and which is due to set sail for America.
A new weapon, Franklin said, feeling the hair on the back of his neck begin to stand up. He'd heard rumors, through the Freemasons of Paris, that the Hessians had been promising the King of England something special, and for which the King might pay a princely sum. So far, Franklin had been unable to come up with anything conclusive, so he'd not bothered to get word to Washington or any of the others. But if the Baron was here tonight, rudely unannounced, it meant that the Baron was bringing more to Franklin's door than mere speculation.
"Yes," said Louis.
"What's the nature of this weapon?" Franklin asked. Von Steuben's frown deepened, and he looked Franklin square in the face before uttering the name Dippel. Franklin closed his eyes, his mouth souring.
"Nonsense," the old American said.
Von Steuben nodded his head up and down twice in affirmation, saying Dippel again.
"The Baron believes you know what to do about it, that you can stop the new female monster."
"Female this time, eh?" "Perhaps," Franklin said. "But there were extenuating circumstances regarding the first example, the details of which I am not at liberty to discuss with the Baron." Von Steuben listened while Louis made his report. Then the Baron began to practically shout, gesticulating with his hands. The young aide calmly said,
"The Baron is sure that this thing is on its way to your country, sir."
"How does the Baron know that?" Franklin asked sharply. Louis repeated the questions to his master and translated the response.
"There are family connections involved, which are too complicated to explain to you tonight, Monsieur Franklin. The Baron hopes that you will understand the gravity of the situation. He also hopes that you will appreciate the fact that the Baron spared no time nor expense in bringing the matter to your attention, before it's too late."
"Ah," Franklin said. "The Baron wants in with Washington that badly, eh? There's still no money in it. Washington can't even pay his own officers, much less Prussian aristocrats seeking to make a name for themselves during a foreign campaign. Why do you think I'm in Paris in the first place, monsieur? For vacation? For the women? It might seem to some that I am an old man on holiday. But the future of my home is at stake, and I am doing everything in my power to ensure that France remains with us during our fight against the English crown." Louis translated and received a response.
"The Baron knows all this already," Louis said, "but he admires what you and Washington are doing. He deems it a righteous quarrel. He hopes that if he assists you in rendering the Hessian weapon harmless, you will in turn pass the good word to Washington regarding the Baron's value and abilities."
"Does the Baron know where this weapon is?"
"Not at the moment," Louis said. "But we believe we know where and when the weapon is due to depart overseas. We need only be there to interdict."
Franklin pulled off his spectacles and rubbed one eye with his fist.
"Like I told you, there were extenuating circumstances the first time, and if we're dealing with what I think we're dealing with, and what you seem to think we're dealing with too, I don't have any alchemical weaponry nor occult incantation with which to send this thing back to hell."
Louis translated. The Baron threw up his hands, eyes rolling.
"Then how, Monsieur Franklin, did you manage it? With the other one? With the one you call Franks?"
It was 3 weeks overland, or 6 days by ship. Both Franklin and von Steuben agreed that the ship was preferable, though they'd need a day in Amsterdam to cover their tracks. which was where Franklin's connections with the Freemasons of Paris came in handy. Kings might make or break agreements at will, but the Freemasons, with their fraternity stretching throughout enlightened homes and courts across Europe, were something else again. Franklin had but to ask, and the network unfolded its rhetorical wings, spiriting him and the Baron across contested international waters and depositing them on decidedly Teutonic shores, without either the French nor the British being any the wiser. For all anyone knew, and Franklin's grandson would tell, the old emissary was at home, recovering from yet another episode of gout. Well-wishers were permitted to leave gifts or notes in the foyer, but no one was allowed to see Franklin in his bed. Now on German soil, it was the Baron who navigated deftly. If anyone in this part of the world noticed von Steuben's dialect or accent, they didn't say it. Perhaps the Baron was simply that good at affecting a local quality whenever he spoke? Benjamin Franklin could not tell. And Louis de Pontierre, for all his talkativeness at sea, had become practically mute now that they were moving in unfamiliar circles. Franklin was simply reminded of the fact that he was old. Too old, certainly, to be undertaking such an adventure without a small host of helpers and assistants to ensure that the American diplomat was properly protected and cared for. If anything happened to him while he was away, William would be hard-pressed to explain Franklin's disappearance. The Continental Congress had to keep the French aligned with the Congress, and almost all of that burden rested on Franklin's shoulders. Still, the mere mention of the name Franks had spurred Benjamin to action. "He's not like any man," Franklin had explained one evening, while he, the Baron, and the Baron's aide were staring over their ship's railing into the greenish depths of the sea. "When they brought him to me, he should have been dead. He took a direct hit from a field gun, a whole cannonball, you understand, to neutralize Franks. When Washington's men dropped the body off with me in Philadelphia, I thought they were depositing a cadaver. Imagine my shock to discover that the torso, or what was left of it, still had a pulse, and that tiny amounts of blood, mingled with that cursed Dipple's oil, flowed in the torso's veins. I knew then that I was dealing with something truly extraordinary." "But how do we stop it?" Louis pleaded, staring past the waves, out to the clouds on the horizon. "I told you," the old diplomat said. "In the case of Franks, it was a direct hit with a field gun. But that did not kill him. I am not even convinced that a creature such as Franks can be killed. Which is why I was amazed to learn, upon sewing the creature back together, using fresh cadavers from the Philadelphia Medical College, that Franks wished to serve the Continental Congress. Can you imagine?" "So, that was it?" Louis said, after repeating Benjamin's words to von Steuben. "Franks is made whole again and bends his knee to your cause?" "No," the old man said. "I knew we couldn't simply make him our slave. We have too much of that back home as it is, you know. We've entered an age when men must do away with that kind of thing. It was wrong in the time of the Pharaoh. It was wrong in the time of Caesar. It remains wrong, even if some of my countrymen disagree. Anyway, I didn't want Franks chained to us. I wanted him with us of his own accord, compacted in agreement, like a man. So, we drew it up formally with stipulations. Franks would serve the Continental Congress, and we would give Franks a cause worth fighting for. With one caveat."
"And that was?" Louis asked, after translating for the Baron.
"Franks made it clear that there would be no more like him."
"What does that mean?"
"Well, putting the poor creature back together, with flesh and bone from several different bodies, I learned enough about him, and also about Dipple's oil, that I probably could have tried to produce a facsimile. I certainly know more about electrical fire than anyone else at home, and it's the electrical fire
combined with Dipple's oil, that makes a thing like Frank's possible. One of the two, by itself, is not sufficient. Combine them in the right ways, with enough raw tissue, and a man might create anything. Even something grotesquely unlike a man. But there's more to it, even than that.
Yes?
Louis said, after a short pause to translate. I deduce that Franks first came to this earth as a disembodied spirit.
You mean like a ghost?
Possibly, though I don't think that word is right. A ghost implies the spirit of one who has lived and died. Franks never even had the chance to live until Johann Conrad Dipple gave him that chance. Now, Baron von Steuben has learned that Dipple did not terminate his experiments after Frank's creation. The Freemasons had assumed that Dipple quit when I was still a young man in England. But it seems Dipple did not. How or why this second creation has eluded attention until now?
So we blow it up,
Louis said, for his master.
Or we burn it, to pieces or to ashes.
That doesn't seem so hard. Washington's troops, in their graves, would disagree with that assessment.
Do you propose to talk to it, then? This she-creature of Dipper's design?
I don't know, sir. Having not even seen it yet, I really don't know. And so, the three men found themselves spying on a ship far from any of their homes, and with only a few pistols tucked into their belts, and no real plan other than to wait and see who or what was taken aboard. Yet again Benjamin Franklin was reminded of his age. Even one night on the harbor, with the damp, cold air making beads of water on his marten fur hat, could be the death of him. The weapon he carried was one the young French aide had loaded for him. Franklin doubted he had the reflexes or the eyes enough to fire and hit anything. Besides, a musket ball would not stop a creature like Frank's any more than a flea might stop Frank's. If things got desperate, the Baron proposed to set the entire ship aflame. The gun holes in the ship's side meant there should be cannon powder aboard. The Baron claimed to know a thing or two about that. Franklin did not, and could not have tried to guide them to the armory. Again, he was a man of reason, not of action. Yet here he was, trying to take action with the skimpiest of reasons. Maybe they would get lucky, and the rumor of the Hessian weapon would turn out to be just that, rumor. They could all have a good laugh about it on the way back to Franklin's Paris home, and Franklin would write an introduction letter on behalf of the Baron to General Washington anyway. Von Steuben may have been a Prussian aristocrat looking to pad his service resume, but he was not a coward. He was prepared to give his life if it meant stopping Dipple's second monster. It showed in von Steuben's eyes. And the young French aide? He would follow his master to hell if necessary. So Franklin would write his letter on behalf of them both. The revolution needed grit. There weren't many lamps on the docks, nor many people. Occasionally, sailors speaking half a dozen different languages wandered past the stack of barrels where von Steuben had hidden just before dusk. There was enough space between the huge casks to watch the specific dock for the specific ship which had been named in von Steuben's communiques. Either his intelligence was right, or it was wrong. Either the she-monster of Johann Dipple was here tonight, or it was not. They would just have to wait and see.
"Wake up, old man,"
whispered Louis. Benjamin Franklin's eyes fluttered open, and he realized he'd fallen asleep, slumping against one of the barrels. His greatcoat was wrapped tightly around him, against the chill, damp air, and he wondered how long he'd been dreaming. In his mind, he had been rebuilding Franks,
over and over and over again, like assembling the grisly pieces of a bloody, putrid puzzle. If he'd not been a man of science, Franklin doubted he'd have had the stomach for it. Even so, repeating the process ad infinitum had been the most unpleasant type of bad dream.
"Is something happening?" Franklin whispered.
"Yeah,"
said von Steuben, who was crouched, peering between the barrels. The Prussian whispered to the Frenchman, and the Frenchman whispered to the American.
"A wagon has arrived. The dock is practically deserted. It's going to be dawn soon, but we're still in complete darkness. No one has gone aboard or left the ship in many minutes. The wagon is just sitting there. It does not appear to be a normal wagon. There are iron bars, and the wood seems to be of a particularly heavy grain. A dozen different men, wearing Hessian uniforms, appear to be waiting nervously. They are armed."
Franklin absorbed the details, not bothering to look for himself. He could well imagine in his mind what it might take to transport Franks safely across country. In Frank's specific case, he had worked for the Hessians by choice, because the Hessians who had been sent to kill Franks had instead made Franks an offer. Much as Franklin himself had eventually made Franks an offer. This new creature? Who knew what motivated it, or what allegiance it felt, if any, to the nations of men? Finally, there was some noise, as if a gate had been opened. Von Steuben continued to report, and Louis continued to translate.
"The side of the wagon has come open, finally. And there is a young woman descending down to a footstool placed before her. She is beautiful. She does not appear to be much over a score of years old. She is dressed as a proper lady of society. Several of the Hessians are bringing out two trunks. The trunks are being carried up to the ship. The woman is being spoken to by one of the Hessian officers."
Franks, robust as he was, had still been a crude work, stronger than a team of oxen, but also just as ugly. Either Dipple had significantly advanced his process and technique between the two inceptions, or Franklin and the Baron had come a long way for nothing. Ben hoped for the latter, but how to be sure?
"We have to get in close," the American whispered. "Sitting up here taking notes doesn't do us much good. We have to look in her eyes. They won't be quite like the eyes of any living man or woman either of you have ever seen. You will understand what I am talking about when the time comes."
Von Steuben asked, and Louis translated.
"How do you propose we do that with so many infantry standing about looking nervous?"
Franklin thought about it for a moment.
"We need a distraction," the American said. "Something spectacular enough that it keeps every single Hessian occupied until we can confront that woman."
The three men sat in silence for many moments. Eyeing what was to either side of them, Franklin finally asked,
"What's in these barrels?"
The oil was cold and viscous, and it flowed out of the bungholes rather sluggishly. Franklin was mildly appalled at the vandalism the three of them had wrought, but none of them had had any better ideas. Once the oil caught, they had to hope it made enough of a fire that all attention would be drawn to the burning barrels. The harbor watch would muster every able body to contain the flames, oil being notoriously difficult to deal with because water would only make it spread, and this might rope the Hessians into assisting, lest they be accused of cowardice. In the confusion and the tumult, Franklin and von Steuben would have their chance. Assuming the young Frenchman could get his fire-starting kit to work.
"Keep trying," Franklin encouraged.
They'd spent so many hours in the dark, the tiny sparks from the flint seemed alarmingly bright. The Hessians or the harbor watch might see them and come to investigate. Von Steuben muttered something under his breath
and tapped one of the muskets on his aide's waist.
"Firing a weapon would be suicide,"
Franklin hissed.
"Even if you did ignite the oil, the noise would draw them right to us, before the flame got big enough to mask our maneuvering."
"No," Louis said, pausing, the whites of his wide eyes just barely visible.
"The Baron suggests we use a bead of powder to ignite the oil."
Louis switched to his powder horn, pouring out a little line of black dust over the surface of the pooling oil. Franklin's eyes could barely make out the young man's hands as he worked.
"You two had better be well away from this when it goes," Louis said. "In fact, far away."
"What about you?"
Franklin asked.
"Assuming I am not burned to death or captured, I will meet you at the gangplank to the ship."
A quick relay of instructions, aide to Baron, then Baron to aide, followed. Von Steuben clapped the Frenchman lightly on the young man's shoulder, then he was leading Franklin out into the dark, cold, exposed night air. The two older men walked calmly, neither pussyfooting nor hurrying. This deep into the wee hours, there were only the few lights near the ships to worry about, and their range was limited. If anyone could see the Baron and the American moving, they would be mere shadows against the backdrop of the sea, with the harbor's black surface gently slapping against pylons and ships' hulls alike. Suddenly, Franklin saw illumination on the side of one of the far ships. Illumination coming from behind him.
"That did it,"
Benjamin said, and then, without having to be told, he and von Steuben changed direction and began to angle over and down toward their destination. At first, only one voice rang out, then several. Every Hessian standing watch pivoted to stare up at the stack of casks, which now boiled with thick, smoky flames. Shouts turned to screams, and then the screams were drowned out by bells, which began to clang loudly, again and again. Glancing occasionally to see how bad the fire had gotten, Franklin again felt a pang of guilt for the vandalism. He did not enjoy destruction for destruction's sake. He'd worked his whole life to build things, not ruin them. He also suddenly realized that such a fire might very well burn out of control, risking innocent lives. The old inventor whispered fervent prayers as he and von Steuben began to make their final lengthy approach to the ship, praying that no innocent lives would be jeopardized this night. It was worth a lot to halt the she-monster of Dipple in its tracks. Even the lives of the three men who'd conspired to confront and combat the beast. But that didn't mean Ben Franklin wanted anybody else to get hurt. Suddenly, the cosmopolitan gentleman from Philadelphia felt a pang of empathy for his comrade Washington. Over on the other side of the Atlantic, George was fighting their cousins, the British, many of whom were not their enemies. Merely Englishmen and Scotsmen, Irishmen, and even Hessians, all pressed into service in the name of King George, who wouldn't let the American colonies out of his grasp without a struggle. Washington's men had to shoot at people who might very well be blood relatives, kin by birth and common heritage. Then Franklin grunted and reminded himself to keep his feet moving, lest he gather so much wool that he fall over and break something. They'd all known the revolution couldn't be had without cost, and while Franklin had been content to serve as that revolution's mouthpiece to continental Europe, he'd never thought he might find himself engaging in any derring do. The old man picked up his feet and stayed after the Baron. The ruse partially worked. About two-thirds of the Hessian troops guarding the wagon left to go deal with the growing fire. One-third stayed behind, while everyone else aboard the ships on several nearby docks, including the specific ship in question, came out on deck to see what was going on. A few men began running down the gangplanks, or climbing over nets and down the sides of their ships to the docks, and dashing to help with the fire. What threatened one boat threatened all boats. Other men simply gawked as the barrels of oil were consumed in a huge geyser of flame that shot several stories into the air. A thick, angry column of black smoke curling off the top and beginning to drift out over the docks and into the harbor town proper. Louis de Pontierre was nowhere to be seen. As the Baron and Franklin both approached their intended destination, no eyes watched them. Everyone was gazing up at the conflagration which had ignited out of nowhere, and about which none of the several hundred men, all cobbled together into an ad hoc fire brigade, seemed to have any idea what to do about, oil being a literally slippery foe for any would-be firefighter to have to handle. The woman, as well as her two trunks, was nowhere to be seen. Noticing this as well, von Steuben didn't stop. He walked right past the Hessian officer who'd been talking to her before, and who now stood gazing at the flames, occasionally shouting to his men, and proceeded up the gangplank, with the old American directly in his wake. Franklin was moving harder than he had in a long time, his blood pounding in his ears, while his breath wheezed in and out of his lungs. Not even the few nights he'd spent in bed with the women of Paris had given him such a workout. But then, the women had understood. The charming American Democrat wasn't the freshest horse in the barn, even if his ideas did send the ladies swooning. Up on deck, one of the ship's crew finally noticed strangers coming aboard and confronted the older men. Hessian to Prussian, von Steuben and their interlocutor argued it out. Whatever von Steuben managed to concoct as their reason being aboard, it satisfied the man who'd barred their path. The bearded sailor moved out of their way and allowed both Franklin and von Steuben to make their way past several more sailors who were all standing and watching the fire, until von Steuben found a doorway that allowed them to take a steep flight of stairs below decks. A second sailor confronted them. Guttural Deutsch flew back and forth between the men. Von Steuben was a natural in command. His demeanor broadcast authority with every syllable. He didn't just belong. He owned. This was his ship. 5 minutes prior, he'd been slowly approaching the vessel like a burglar. Now von Steuben barked orders like he was the captain himself. Sailors came out of side passages, listened just long enough to decide they didn't want a piece of the gruff, imperious older man in the officious-looking officer's garb, and they quickly vanished back to where they'd been pretending to sleep through the alarm on the dock. Finally, both von Steuben and Franklin arrived at a single, closed, and apparently locked cabin door. The Baron thumped a fist on the door proper, commanding entry. A woman's voice, surprisingly and disarmingly pleasant, speaking perfectly in German, filtered back through the wood. Von Steuben's face showed surprise. Then he thumped the wood again, and commanded entry a second time. Then he thumped the wood a third time, gave a third command, and, lacking better alternatives, pulled one of the pistols from his belt and aimed it at the lock. The pistol report, in the cramped spaces below decks, was deafening. But it did get the door open, with smoke curling all around, and splinters of wood and metal all over the deck beneath their feet. Von Steuben barely got two strides into the cabin when a force of nature leapt from the shadows. A single set of candles on a tiny cabin table whooshed out, but not before Benjamin Franklin had a glimpse of the beast. Arms outstretched, like a bat clawing the air, teeth bared, with eyes
Yes. The eyes. There could be no mistaking it now. Dipple had returned to his fiendish work, honing, practicing, apparently perfecting. Where Frank's was a blundering buffalo,